And then he delivered what I'm going to call a farewell address to his apostles. And in that farewell address, Jesus made two very important and significant promises. Jesus promised that he was going to go and prepare a place for his disciples, and then he promised that he would send the Holy Spirit to help them. We're going to look at the first 14 or 15 verses of John chapter 14 in our study right now that I have entitled, I Go to Prepare a Place for You. Now, before I talk about this important promise, there's something that I think it's important for me to emphasize, and that is that Jesus is talking to his apostles in this farewell discourse. The Synoptic Gospels clearly tell us that Jesus observed the Passover with the 12. Matthew says in Matthew 26, verse 20, when evening had come, he sat down with the 12. Mark says the same thing. And in Mark 14, 20, speaking of Jesus, Mark says, he answered and said to them, it is one of the 12 who dips with me in the dish. And Luke says, when the hour had come, he sat down and the 12 apostles with him. Several of the apostles are mentioned by name in this farewell discourse. We certainly can't take the time to look at these verses, but I just want you to notice that in this farewell discourse, Judas Iscariot, Simon Peter, the beloved disciple, Thomas, Philip, Judas not Iscariot, all of these men are mentioned, and no one else is mentioned except Jesus, of course. I also want to point out to you that there is evidence in this farewell discourse that Jesus was talking to people who had actually been with him. For example, in John 14, verse 8, he tells his audience that he would not leave them as orphans, but he would come to them. We'll have more to say about that later. He tells his audience that they would see him. The people that he's talking about were present with Jesus. They had been taught by Jesus. They had been chosen by Jesus. And in John 15, verse 20, we are told that believers would keep their word. Those with Jesus on this occasion were told that they would bear witness of him, that they had been with Jesus from the beginning, that they couldn't bear all of Jesus' teaching at the moment. Jesus says in John 16, 12, I have more to tell you, I'm paraphrasing, but you're not ready for that yet. And those to whom Jesus was speaking were told that they would not see Jesus for a little while and then see him again, and their sorrow would be turned to joy. That they believed that Jesus came from God, that they would be scattered and leave Jesus alone. That they would be given to Jesus out of the world. They would be given the Father's word. They would be sent into the world. Who is Jesus talking about? Isn't it obvious from these contextual clues that Jesus was talking to the apostles? Now, I'm emphasizing this because there are some statements that Jesus makes in this farewell discourse that I believe apply exclusively to the apostles. In other words, they do not apply to you and me today. I'm not saying that nothing in this farewell discourse applies to us today. That's not my point. But I do believe that there are some things that Jesus says here that had specific application to the apostles. And I think that's an important point to emphasize, because many people today will read what Jesus said about the helper that he was going to send, and they apply those promises to themselves. And I think that's a mistake, and we'll have more to say about that as we go on. Jesus begins this discourse by telling his apostles, "Let not your hearts be troubled. You believe in God. Believe also in me." Now, if you're reading from a different translation, it may read differently. And the reason that it reads differently is because in the original Greek text, the words that Jesus uses can be either second person plural indicative, a statement, and imperative, a command. In other words, what Jesus says, "Believe in God, believe also in me," that can be an indicative or that can be a statement. And that's why our translations read somewhat differently. A Greek scholar by the name of A.T. Robertson said, "Both may be indicative, ye believe and ye believe. Both may be imperative, believe and believe or believe also." Maybe that's too much of that. And so I'm going to flip through these slides quickly. But Jesus says in verse 2, "In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you, I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also." I forgot to mention that when Jesus told his disciples, "Let not your hearts be troubled," Jesus had already told them some things earlier that would have been very troubling to them. He told them that he was going to go away, that he would die, that one of them would betray him, that Peter would deny him three times before the next morning, that Satan was at work against all of them, and that all of the disciples would fall away. Now imagine that you're sitting there, one of the 12, after Jesus has said all of these things. Would your heart be troubled? I think so. Some suggest that what Jesus was really saying here is stop being troubled. And there's irony in this, because it was Jesus who was headed for the agony of the cross. We are told, for example, in John chapter 11, verse 33, that Jesus was troubled, it's the same word, at the tomb of Lazarus. And on Monday of Passion Week, John says in John 12, 27, that Jesus was troubled as he contemplated the cross. And in John 13, verse 21, Jesus was troubled by the thought that Judas was going to betray him. And so Jesus is telling the apostles, "Let not your hearts be troubled," and he was troubled. But he had good reason to be troubled. And he urges them to believe in God and in him. He wants the disciples to understand that they could relieve their troubled hearts by faith. And I think there's a lesson here, and the lesson is this: the answer for trouble is trust. Is your heart ever troubled? It is, isn't it? There are times when all of us are troubled. Jesus says the solution for trouble is trust. And Leon Morris, in his commentary, made a very helpful observation, at least it was to me. He said we should not miss the challenge implied in the call to have faith in Jesus himself. It is one thing for the disciples to have faith in the God who acted in the days of old. It is another to have faith in the Jesus who stands before them, especially when he is even then being betrayed by one of his followers and about to be denied three times by the chief of them, abandoned by the rest, and crucified by his enemies. And I see another lesson there, and that is sometimes it's hard to trust. But it's possible. We can trust Jesus even when it's hard. And that's what Jesus was calling upon his disciples to do. And so in verse 2, he promises to go and prepare a place for them. And now I've caught up to my charts. Where was Jesus going? Well, he answers that question earlier in John's gospel. He's already said that he was going back to where he had come before, that he was going to heaven, that he was going to the one who had sent him, that he was going to God, that he was going to his Father. And other writers tell us that when Jesus ascended to heaven, he sat down at the right hand of God. That's where Jesus was going. And then Jesus says, as it is rendered in the Old King James and the New King James, "In my Father's house are many mansions." And if you're reading from a different translation, it might say many rooms, many dwelling places, many abodes. I'll come back to that in a moment. But when Jesus refers to his Father's house, there are some who believe that he was talking about the church. This word that is translated rooms or dwelling places is only used, I should say the expression "my Father's house" is only found two times in the New Testament. The first time was back in John chapter 2 verse 16 when Jesus said of the Jews, "You've made my Father's house a den of robbers or a den of thieves." And then it's here in this passage. My friend Jeff Smeltzer believes that the Father's house in this passage is a reference to the church. Jeff presented this view of this passage in the SITS conference just a few weeks ago. In his notes, he asked the question, if the house is the temple, but it's a spiritual temple, why is it not the church? Whether here on earth or glorified in heaven or both. And certainly, the New Testament describes the church as the temple of God or the house of God. For example, in Ephesians chapter 2, you might turn there and read with me. Notice what Paul says in verses 19 and following. "Now therefore you are no longer strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household of God, having been built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone, in whom the whole building being fitted together grows into a holy temple in the Lord." That one passage talks about the church being the household of God and the temple of God. Most folks believe And Jeff hasn't convinced me of his view. He's a really good guy and a good Bible student. Most believe that Jesus is talking about heaven. And there's many, many passages that describe heaven as the dwelling place of God. Earlier, back in John chapter 8 and verse 14, Jesus had said that he knew where he came from and where he was going, but the Jews knew neither of those things. Well, where was that? Was that the church or was that heaven? Earlier, Jesus had told the Jews that he was going to go away to him who sent me, and they couldn't follow him there. Well, what's that talking about? It would seem to me that's talking about heaven. Let's go back to the mansions. That's the way the old King James reads. But that's not the idea. That's not what the original Greek word means. I mean, when we use the word mansion today, what do we think of? How many of you have been to the Biltmore House? When you think of a mansion, isn't that something like what you think? Or if you were Downton Abbey fans, Highclere Castle. That's the real place. That's what we think about when we use the word mansion. But in 1611, when the King James Version was translated, they didn't use the word mansion in that way, or at least they didn't use it exclusively in that way. And so that's why more recent translations render it many rooms, dwelling places, many abodes. I hate to burst your bubble, but Jesus was not talking about a mansion like Highclere Castle or the Biltmore House. And of course, that reminds me of one of our hymns, "I'm satisfied with just a cottage below, a little silver and a little gold. But in that city where the ransom will shine, I want a gold one that's silver lined." And then the chorus, "I've got a mansion just over the hilltop in that bright land where we'll never grow old. And someday yonder we will never more wander but walk the streets that are purest gold." Folks, that's not what Jesus is talking about here in John 14. Maybe messes up some funeral sermons, but that's not the idea. And I see a lesson there, and that is sometimes our hymns get it wrong. And we need to sing our hymns with understanding. There are some hymns that I just cannot in good conscience sing because I just think they get it wrong. Now, generally, I don't make a big deal out of that. I just don't sing. But may I suggest to you, it's not a good idea to just mindlessly sing our hymns. Okay, that was a little rabbit that I ran. Jesus says, "I go to prepare a place for you," and most folks view that as Jesus promising dwelling places for his people in heaven. But again, there's some folks, like my friend Jeff Smeltzer and others, who believe that Jesus was talking about establishing positions of authority in the church for the apostles. Barry asked me how far I was going to get. Are you going to get down to verse 6? And I said, well, I'm hoping for verse 15, and I'm in big trouble. I I don't have time to talk about the arguments for the view that this is talking about Jesus establishing positions of authority for the apostles in the church and the arguments against all of that. Some believe that you've got both ideas, that there was an immediate fulfillment when God established the apostles in the foundation of the church, for example, and then there's an ultimate fulfillment. Well, I can't get into all of that. But let me remind you that Jesus has already said that he was going to return to the Father. I'm not convinced that this second view is correct. It's intriguing to me. I still believe that Jesus was talking about dwelling places in heaven. If that is correct, that's certainly the majority view. The lesson that I see is a lesson that you've heard preachers say countless times, and that is that heaven is a prepared place for a prepared people. And maybe we've heard that so many times that it has become trite to us, but it is not trite, it is true. No one is going to be with God by accident. We're not going to slip in the pearly gates holding on to somebody else's coattail. Heaven is a prepared place for a prepared people. In verse 3, Jesus promises to come again and receive them to himself. And there's different ideas about what that is referring to. Is this coming again referring to his post-resurrection appearances when he appeared to the apostles on more than one occasion after the resurrection? Is it talking about Jesus sending the comforter or the helper that he mentions later in the chapter? Is he talking about the second coming? It would seem to me that he's talking about the second coming. Jesus says in verse 4 that they knew where he was going and the way. Jesus had been showing them the way to the Father all throughout his public ministry. And that's when Thomas speaks up in verse 5, and he asks, Lord, or he says rather, Lord, we do not know where you're going, and how can we know the way? Well, that's a pretty sensible question, it seems to me. I mean, if you don't know where you're going, how are you going to know how to get there? Kathy and I are headed to Elmira, New York after services this morning, and I must tell you, I don't know how to get there, but I've got GPS. And it's going to take me there. Well, Jesus responds to Thomas in verse 6. He says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. If you had known me, you would have known my Father also, and from now on you know him and have seen him. This is the sixth of Jesus' seven I am statements in the Gospel of John. And notice he says that he is the way. He doesn't merely show the way. He is himself the way. It's true that he teaches the way and he guides us in the way and has dedicated a new and living way for his people. But all of this is true only because he himself is the way and he is the truth. Later on in John's Gospel, when Jesus appears before Pilate, Pilate will ask the important question, what is truth? Well, Jesus has already answered that question here. He says, I am the truth, and he is the life. Because Jesus has life within himself, he is the source and the giver of life. He has already told us back in John 8, verse 12, that he has the light of life. And in John 6:68, Peter said to Jesus, when Jesus, after so many disciples walked away, and Jesus asked, will you go away too? And Peter said, where shall we go? You have the words of life. Notice, Jesus says that he is the way and the truth and the life. He doesn't say he's a way, a truth, a life, but the way, the truth, the life. He's the only way to salvation. This is an important lesson for us to understand. Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. And Jesus went on to say at the end of verse 6, no one comes to the Father except through me. Jesus is the only way to the Father. It's not through Muhammad. It's not through Buddha or Confucius. It's not through the Pope. It's not through Joseph Smith. It's not through the Watchtower Society. It's not through one's own self. Jesus is the only way to God. Now, if that sounds exclusive, it is. But Jesus is the one who made this statement. I didn't make it. I didn't say this. Jesus made this statement, and there are some implications that are obvious, implications that we need to accept and not try to explain away or excuse or apologize for. Jesus says in verse 7, if you had known me, you would have known my Father also. The pronoun you here is plural, so he's not just talking to Thomas, he's talking to all of the apostles. That's when Philip speaks up in verse 8, Lord, show us the Father and it is sufficient for us. Apparently, Philip wanted Jesus to provide some kind of visible manifestation of God. That's called a theophany. You learned a new word. Now, you don't have to remember it necessarily. But you'll recall that in the Old Testament, God manifested himself to Jacob, to Samson's parents, to Moses, to the elders of Israel, to Isaiah, to Ezekiel. Well, Jesus responds by asking the question of verse 9, have I been with you so long and yet you have not known me, Philip? He who has seen me has seen the Father, so how can you say, show us the Father? Do you not believe that I am in the Father and the Father in me? The words that I speak to you, I do not speak on my own authority, but the Father who dwells in me does the works. Believe me that I am in the Father and the Father in me, or else believe me for the sake of the works themselves. Well, an important lesson that I see in these words of Jesus is that Jesus reveals God. And this echoes something that the writer has told us in the prologue to this gospel. Back in John 1, verse 18, the writer said, no one has seen God at any time. The only begotten Son who is in the bosom of the Father has declared him. This word declared is where we get our word exegesis, or to exegete. Jesus has explained the Father. Paul told the Colossians in Colossians 1 verse 15, speaking of Jesus, He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. Have you noticed that Ava is the image of her daddy? And her daddy is the image of his mama? Well, now, if you can understand what I meant when I said that, you can understand how Jesus would say, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. They're not one and the same person, but they are so much alike that Jesus reveals God. Oh, my. Another lesson I see here is that Jesus' words, this is verse 10, I think it is, Jesus' words are the Father's words. Jesus wasn't going it alone. He wasn't freelancing. He was teaching only what the Father gave him to teach. And if Jesus only spoke what he got from the Father, what does that tell us about what we should speak? And then in verse 10, another lesson I see here is that Jesus' works were God's works. In other words, God was working through his Son. Jesus' miracles were evidence of his deity. Well, in verse 12, Jesus says, "Most assuredly, I say to you, he who believes in me, the works that I do, he will do also, and greater works than these he will do, because I go to my Father." Hang on, Jeff. These greater works were not more in number. He's not saying the apostles were going to perform more miracles than he did. In fact, John ends his book by saying the world couldn't contain the books that would report everything that Jesus did. I don't think it means that their miracles were greater in power, because Jesus healed the sick and raised the dead and cast out demons, and the apostles did the same things. So what are these greater works? Well, I think they are greater in nature, in that I think Jesus is talking about spiritual works. What would be accomplished through the preaching of the gospel? And they would have greater impact and effect. At Jesus' death, how many disciples did he have? There were 120 waiting in the upper room, we're told in Acts chapter 1. But on the day of Pentecost, 3,000 people were brought to the Lord. And a little while later, 5,000 men had become Christians. And Christianity spread throughout the Roman Empire. So there were many more converts and much wider influence. And I've got to stop here. Thank you.